Hello and welcome to a podcast about murder. I'm Jem and I'm here with Freya for another discussion about true crime. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling good. Yeah.
Ready to discuss some murder?
Yep, some horrendous behavior. Let's go.
So today we'll be discussing an old unsolved case, the murder of Artemis Ogletree. This is an American case, often called the Mystery of Room 1046. As a warning to listeners, the victim in this case died of wounds resulting from a severe beating and stabbing, possibly inflicted as a form of torture. So, as always, feel free to give this episode a miss if you'd rather not hear about that. So I'm going to start by giving a little bit of a timeline of events.
Mm-hmm.
So, on January 2nd, 1935, at around 1 p.m., a young man arrived at the Hotel President in Kansas City, Missouri. Not Kansas City, Kansas. Because I assumed a place called Kansas City would be in Kansas, but it is not. It is in Missouri.
Is that a fact? I did not realize that either. I always assumed Kansas City was in Kansas.
Well,
but maybe that's why they decided to call it Kansas City to like avoid confusion.
But that's just crazy to call.
Yeah, no, very strange behavior, I think.
Okay. But there is a Kansas City, Kansas as well. Apparently.
That's even worse. No, that's absolutely demented behavior. I think they should stop.
He was well-dressed but had no luggage with him. He asked to check into a room. He specified that he wanted one several floors up, not facing out onto the street. He signed his name Roland T. Owen and stated that he came from Los Angeles. He paid for a single night stay. Hotel staff described him as being between 20 and 35 years old, which is quite a range, but as we've discussed on here before, I'm also very bad at estimating people's ages, so I don't know. You could be 35 and particularly young looking, or 20 and quite old.
I'm pretty bad with ages, but I think I'd know if you were 20 versus 35. I mean
15 years is quite a range. Like,
I think when it 28 to 35, you know, like late 20s to mid 30s, people look broadly similar. I don't know. I am pretty bad with it though.
They also noted that he had a large scar on his head and a cauliflower ear, which is basically an injury that occurs when the ear has been hit and forms a blood clot or a buildup of liquid underneath the skin, permanently swelling and deforming the outer part of the ear around the cartilage.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that before, like about, I want to say like 6 months ago. And I only heard that was a thing that like loads of boxers have.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, because he had this injury, they assumed that he was some kind of professional boxer or wrestler. But I'd never heard of this injury before looking into this case. Owen was given room 1046. He was shown to his room by Randolph Probst, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, a bellboy. As they made their way up to the 10th floor, Owen explained to Probst that he had spent the previous night at the Muleback Hotel, but found their nightly rates too expensive. Probst let Owen into his room and watched as he removed a hairbrush, comb, and toothpaste from his overcoat pockets. The two then left the room together, making their way down the corridor. Probst went back to turn the lights off and lock the door before handing the room key to Owen. Probst went back to the lobby and watched Owen leave the hotel. Later that afternoon, one of the maids, Mary Soptic, came to clean room 1046. She was surprised to be let into the room by Owen, as the previous tenant had been a woman. So I guess she was just uninformed that there had been a change in tenants. Soptic noted that the curtains were closed and that the only light in the room came from a dim desk lamp. While she cleaned, Owen put on his coat and got ready to go out. Before he left, he asked her not to lock the door, as he was expecting friends. Soptic finished cleaning the room and left the door unlocked as she left, as requested. She returned a few hours later at 4 p.m. with fresh towels for the room. The door was unlocked and dark as she had left it, so she was surprised to find Owen lying on the bed, fully dressed. She deposited the towels and noticed a handwritten note on the desk which read, "Don, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait." In her statement to the police, Soptic noted that Owen always wanted to keep the room dark and described him as being worried or afraid of something.
Right. So possibly on the run from some shady characters.
Yeah. So it's definitely odd behavior. The next day, January 3rd, Mary Sopcich returned to the room at around 10:30 a.m. She opened the room with her pass key, something that she would only be able to do if the room had been locked from the outside. She therefore assumed that Owen would be out and was startled to find him sitting in the dark in the same place he had been the previous day. This meant that someone else had locked the room from the outside, with Owen still in it.
Okay, that's super weird.
Yeah.
But who would have been able to do that? Like, do you have to have, like, a room key?
I think you have to have a room key. So what I'm assuming is that he met someone, or someone found him at the hotel and then took his key and locked him in the room.
Right, so he's, like...
Whether yeah, he's he was, like, you know, a voluntary participant in that or not, or, like, I can't...
It's strange to volunteer to be locked in a room by someone else.
Yeah, because... But, yeah. If it's a security thing, just lock yourself in the room and let them in when they get back. Either this is like a sinister thing and someone is like keeping him stuck in this room, or it's for his protection to stop other people from getting into the room. But then why can't he just lock people out?
Right. So you think maybe...
And then you have like a secret knock to let him know that it's you and he'll let you in.
So you can lock... What you're saying is you can lock the room from the inside.
You can lock the room from the inside, and I believe that that would have prevented the maid from opening it from the outside.
Right. So the status of being, of the differences of it being locked is if it's locked from the outside, anyone, that like, that's, the mechanism is so that housekeeping can enter while you're not there. But if you are there, then they won't be able to get in, which makes sense.
I assume that the reason that detail is important is because... It says something about the state of, like, who locked the door and from which side of the door. And also he's sitting there in the dark again, which is slightly strange.
Yeah, super weird.
As she began cleaning, the phone rang. Owen answered, reportedly saying, "No, Don, I don't want to eat. I am not hungry. I just had breakfast. No, I am not hungry." So I couldn't find any indication of the tone, which would definitely change a lot about this speech.
Mm.
But I would say that the whole scene is quite strange.
My first thought is that that could be code.
Yeah. Repeating. For like, yeah.
Either I'm safe or I'm not, or like, you can bring this or don't bring this. You know, that kind of thing. But it's like, my first thought is that it doesn't refer to eating, particularly because the time, like, if he's also saying, like, "I just had breakfast," so it's like, it's almost like it doesn't make sense being asked that. So that's my first thought about that. And then I'm also thinking, based off of that, that if he's, like, in danger, like, maybe some kind of spy-related thing or like, undercover-related thing, that it makes, that maybe someone would lock him in as his, like, his handler or his, like, not bodyguard, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, the fact of repeating, "I am not hungry," like, really insistently, definitely makes it sound like it's some kind of code word for something. Like, "No, I'm not hungry. Please understand what I'm saying." As Mary cleaned the room, Owen chatted with her, still sitting on the bed in the dark. He asked her about her job at the hotel and repeated the complaint he had made to the bellboy Probst about the expensive rates of the Muleback Hotel. When she had finished cleaning the room, Mary took the dirty towels and left. She returned with clean towels at 4 p.m, the same time as the previous day. She heard two men talking in Owen's room when she arrived. She knocked and was answered by a man with a rough voice who claimed that they didn't need any towels, which she obviously found odd as she knew that she had taken all the towels that morning.
Right. Which is either like, go away, or it's like telling her to take away the towels is like just a cover to get her to go or something.
Yeah, I mean, I would just assume they're having a conversation and they don't want her to come in.
Want to be overheard. Yeah.
That afternoon, a woman named Jean Owen, no relation, checked into the hotel president. She had come from Lee's Summit to do some shopping and visit her boyfriend, Joe Reinert. She had felt too ill to drive back home that day and had decided to check into her hotel for the night. She stayed in room 1048, not too far from Roland T. Owen. Her boyfriend came to visit her that evening and left around 11:30. After his departure, Jean said she heard a lot of raucous noise coming from one of the rooms on her floor. She could make out both men and women talking loudly and swearing. The elevator operator, Charles Blocker, also reported unusual activity that night. His shift began at midnight. The first 3 hours of his shift were particularly busy. A woman, who he had seen at the hotel on previous occasions with different men, and who he therefore assumed was a prostitute, called the elevator to go to the 10th floor. Here's where things become a little confusing for me to follow.
Okay.
But bear with me. Apparently, during the ride-up, she asked about room 1026. 5 minutes after he dropped her off, the lift was called back to the 10th floor by the same woman, who was confused that her client was not in room 1046 and wondered if he was perhaps in room 1024, as she had seen that the light was on in that room.
Okay.
Following this discussion with Blocker, she decided to stay on the 10th floor. Half an hour later, the lift was called back by the same woman who asked to be taken to the lobby, which he did. An hour later, the same woman, this time accompanied by a man, asked to be taken up to the 9th floor. At 4:15 a.m., this woman left the hotel. Shortly afterwards, the man she had gone up to the 9th floor with also left, explaining to Blocker that he couldn't sleep and needed to go for a walk. So, I'm not sure how relevant this woman's comings and goings are, but just something to bear in mind.
Some strange sort of strange behavior from other people in the hotel, maybe.
Yeah.
And also, I find it interesting, although this has nothing to do with the case, but I find it interesting that it's at that time where there's an elevator operator.
Yeah.
There's like a guy who's always got to be in the lift, like working it for you.
Yeah, and his shift starts at midnight. Like, we have to have someone in the lift at all times.
That's one of those jobs where it's like, everyone's glad that automation has got rid of that.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that job.
Like, imagine having to sit in an elevator for like 6 hours.
Yeah, on the off chance that someone might
That's
need
crazy.
To use it during the night. So boring. I hope he had a good book.
I hope so. Blocker also reported that there had been a loud party going on in room 1055 that evening. So just something to bear in mind. This might be the source of the noise that Jean heard that evening.
Lots of lots of stuff is going on in this hotel that yeah. could be relevant, could not be relevant, yeah. but is like just stuff going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, lots of people
is
moving
there, is
about.
There, does hotel have any like any kind of reputation?
I don't think so. I mean, I
or
guess
it
it's a cheaper hotel because he commented that the rates of the other hotel were too expensive for him.
And based off of the fact that he meets this woman and assumes she's a prostitute.
Yeah, like she's been seen, basically, I assume he sees her coming and going quite frequently and assumes that she probably takes her clients to the hotel, which sort
yeah,
of gives
yeah,
an indication of
like... Yeah, so it's not
like
the highest, you know, it's like, is it still sort of maybe seedy?
Yeah, maybe.
Potentially? Or is that just, maybe that's just, they could take him anywhere, I guess.
I guess, but that probably speaks to like, the rooms must be pretty cheap. And people won't necessarily, like...
Ask questions.
Comment. Yeah. So, the next morning, January 4th, at 7 a.m., switchboard operator Della Ferguson started her shift. She was preparing to make the wake-up call to room 1046 when she noticed that the phone for the room was off the hook. She asked a member of staff to go and check on the room. Randolph Probst, the bellboy who had taken Owen to his room 2 days prior, went to check on the situation. When he arrived, he saw a Do Not Disturb sign on the door handle. He knocked on the door and a voice inside asked him to enter, but the door was locked. He knocked again and the same voice asked him to turn on the lights. Assuming Owen must be drunk, he shouted through the door asking him to hang up the phone and went back to work. When the phone had still not been hung up, about an hour and a half later, Harold Pike, another bellboy, was sent up to investigate. The Do Not Disturb sign was still on the door and the door was still locked, but Harold let himself in using his passkey. Presumably this again meant that the door had been locked from the outside, as it had been when Mary Soptic had come the day before. Harold saw Owen lying naked on the bed in the dark, breathing heavily. He also assumed he must be drunk. He noticed some darker patches on the bed, but assumed it was just a strange shadow. He hung up the phone and left. Around 10:30 a.m., another operator noticed that the phone in room 1046 was once again off the hook. Randolph Probst was sent to handle the situation. This time, he had a key and let himself in. As he entered the room, he was greeted with a gruesome sight. The following quote apparently comes from his police statement. "When I entered the room, this man was within 2 feet of the door, on his knees and elbows, holding his head in his hands. I notice blood on his head. Then I turn the light on, place the telephone receiver on the hook. I looked around and saw blood on the walls, on the bed, and in the bathroom. This frightened me, and I immediately left the room and went downstairs.
I get it. I get why he immediately left and was frightened. Yeah. But it still strikes me as kind of odd that he comes in and puts the phone on the receiver. Like, I've got to still do my job.
The chain of events is so funny to me because he turns on the lights, then puts the phone on the hook, and then notices the blood. Like, if he
does initially notice, like, a person in, like, in distress on the floor, and then he's like, better put the phone back on the hook anyway. So the next one, oh no, I'm frightened, I'm gonna go.
I think this is one of those, like, stress reactions where it's like, you're so freaked out by what you've seen that you're like, I came in here to put the phone on the hook, and then you, like, register how bad the situation is, but you're so freaked out that you're like, my instinct is to do what I initially came here to do.
Yeah, he's obviously got a weird fight or flight little flight response, but like, yeah, just a strange, like, computation of the brain there where it's like, better still put do the job.
When Randolph returned with the assistant manager, they were unable to open the door as Owen had collapsed behind it. He was eventually able to move, and the assistant manager called the police while Probst helped Owen sit on the side of the bathtub.
So he's still alive at this point.
Yeah. Well, because basically what I assume was happening was that he was, like, trying to call people to come and help him.
Yeah.
And was just being ignored and has somehow, like, was then moving towards the door and kept collapsing. So he's in a very weak state, but is still alive. The police quickly arrived at the scene. Detectives Ira Johnson and William Eldridge, as well as Detective Sergeant Frank Howard and Dr. Harold F. Flanders, were the first on the scene. Owen had been tied up. There was cord around his wrists, ankles, and neck. It looked as though he had been tortured. He was badly beaten around the head. His skull had been fractured. He had also been stabbed in the chest, which had punctured his lung, and it looked as if he had also been strangled. However, when police asked him who had done this to him, he simply replied, "Nobody." And claimed that he had injured himself slipping against the bathtub.
Oh my god. So this is definitely like some kind of either mob thing or, like, you know, something like that. Like a spy thing or a mafia thing or something where he feels he can't say shit about this. But it's like... Yeah.
It's like, your hands are tied together, my guy.
I can't believe you could be in this state and be like, oh, I tripped and fell.
Like, I guess that really is like the blood loss talking where you're like, yeah, maybe this is believable. Before they could question him further, he collapsed. They rushed him to the hospital, but he fell into a coma on the way there. He died that night, slightly after midnight. Dr. Flanders was able to ascertain that the wounds must have been inflicted at least 7 hours before they discovered Owen. The blood on the wounds themselves had started to harden, and the blood on the walls was dry. This meant that the attack would have taken place around 3 or 4 a.m., The detective search of the room didn't turn up much. As we already know, Owen had very few possessions. They noted that all of the hotel toiletries and towels were missing and were unable to find any kind of weapon in the room. This ruled out the possibility of attempted suicide.
Well, yeah. Attempted suicide? Well, yeah, but... What a shock. Like, what?
I guess you have to rule it out, but it's the fact that, like, there is literally nothing in the room that he could have stabbed himself with. Shows that someone else has to have been involved.
Okay, but also, like, his hands were tied together.
Yeah.
So, like...
But, I mean, you gotta do your due diligence, I guess. Like, you gotta really...
I guess so, but, like, when you find a guy who's, like, been beaten and stabbed and his hands are tied together, I would never in a million years be like, better rule out attempted suicide. Because that makes sense. Just imagining this guy, like, dragging himself around this room, like, hitting himself in the face and shit.
Jesus
just
Christ.
Mental.
Yeah, like, the degree to which he's injured, like, I don't think it would physically be possible for you to inflict that kind of damage. Also, the towels missing, I'm like, yeah, maybe that is suspicious, or maybe he just never got fresh towels because they sent the maid away. Like,
yeah, well, that's what I was just thinking. Is it? That's not strange, is it? Because
no, I don't think so.
They didn't ever get the fresh towels.
The toiletries missing is maybe, like, maybe you could say that someone took them, but...
What kind of toiletries?
I'm not sure.
Because if it's like tissue, like perhaps there was like a struggle of some kind and that person used like the tissue paper in the room to like patch themselves up and then left.
Yeah. I mean, what I find odd is that like, how did these people like, I mean, I guess maybe they just took the stairs, but surely they must also be covered in blood, whoever did this.
You would think.
And no one noticed that.
Hmm.
The only things they were able to find in the room were a label from a necktie, which showed that it came from a company in New Jersey, a hairpin, a safety pin, an unsmoked cigarette, and a full small bottle of sulfuric acid.
Oh.
It was like sealed though, so it hadn't been
Yeah, but that's a weird used. One.
It's odd. Two water glasses were found in the bathroom. One was intact on the shelf. The other, missing a large piece, was lying in the sink.
Hmm.
They also found four fingerprints on a glass by the phone. As they were quite small, they believed they must belong to a woman. So they sent the fingerprints, as well as Owen's, off to the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation, and it became quickly apparent that Roland T. Owen was an alias. Kansas City police had gotten in touch with the LAPD in order to notify Owen's family and were informed that there was no record of a person named Roland T. Owen living in California at that time.
Mm.
As Randolph Probst and Mary Soptic recalled having a conversation with Owen about his stay at the Muleback Hotel, police went to investigate the hotel. There was no record of a man named Roland T. Owen spending a night there, but a man matching his description had checked in under the name Eugene K. Scott, and had also given Los Angeles as his home address. The LAPD reported that no one by that name resided in Los Angeles either. On Sunday the 6th of January, people came to view Owen's body at the Melody McGilley Funeral Home. People were hoping that someone might be able to identify the body or offer a new lead. One of the people who came to see the body was Robert Lane, a city worker. He recalled a strange encounter he had had on the night of January 3rd. Around 11 p.m., he was driving on 13th Street near Lydia Avenue when he was flagged down by a man wearing only an undershirt, trousers, and shoes. Keep in mind that this is early January, so I assume it's pretty cold outside. The man apologized for mistakenly assuming that Lane was a taxi driver, then asked if he could give him a lift to where he would be able to get a taxi. Lane agreed, and the man got in his car. Lane noticed that the man had a deep scratch on his arm and was holding himself in a way that suggested he was preventing another, more serious wound from bleeding out. Lane commented on the man's injuries, and the man replied that he would kill the person responsible for his injuries tomorrow.
Okay.
Again, no indication of tone, which would change
that
how...
That would actually change. That would change it, but it's still regardless... A strange thing to say.
Yeah, at this point, I would be regretting letting this man into my car.
Yeah.
Lane dropped the man off at the intersection of 12th and Troost Avenue. He saw him go over to a taxi and honk its horn in order to get the attention of the driver, who was sitting in a nearby restaurant.
Wait, so he reaches into this guy's cab and honks the horn to get the attention of the guy who's sitting in front of him?
No, so this guy has dropped him off at like a taxi rank. Because it's the middle of the night or like very late out, the taxi drivers are like in a cafe nearby. So he's like honking the horn to alert.
I was picturing the cabs pulled up in like, you know, waiting for customers and him just leaning in and honking the horn of a cab. I was like, what?
No, that is it. Yeah, so he is honking the horn of the cab, but there's no one in the car as he's doing that. He's trying to like get the driver to come out.
So he's reached into a empty cab because the driver's not in there.
Yeah.
Honked the horn to get the driver to notice him. Still very, very strange behavior.
Slight, I mean, very forward behavior.
Yeah.
But maybe that's typical of the time. I don't know.
Everyone was reaching into cabs, just honking horns.
Willy-nilly. Lane told the police his story after noticing that Owen had a similar scratch on his arm as the man he had picked up that night. Police were skeptical that the individual from Lane's story was Owen, as none of the hotel staff had seen him leaving or entering the hotel at times that would match Lane's story. They were, however, able to establish a sighting of Owen accompanied by two women at quote-unquote liquor places on 12th Street that evening. Many other people contacted the Kansas City Police Department hoping to identify Owen as a missing family member or friend, as the story was running in the papers and on the radio. Many of these leads ended up going nowhere, and the case steadily grew colder. On March 3rd, the funeral home where Owen's body was being kept announced in the newspapers that he would be buried the following day in the city's Potter's Field. That day, they received a call from a man asking them to delay the funeral so that he could send money for a proper service to be held in Kansas City, Kansas.
Mm.
So not Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay.
The funeral home told the man that they would have to inform the police of this conversation, to which the caller replied that he knew and was unbothered by this. When the funeral owner asked the man why Owen had been killed, the caller explained that Owen had cheated on his fiancée with another woman. These two women and the caller would have conspired to kill Owen as revenge. The call ended with the anonymous man reportedly shouting, "Cheaters get what's coming to them," before he hung up. On March 23rd, the funeral home received $25 in cash wrapped in newspaper, presumably from the anonymous caller. Just to give you an idea, $25 is roughly equivalent to $485 in modern day currency. So that's a lot for this person to be investing in a funeral for this man that they've presumably killed. A local florist received a similar phone call and a payment of $5 with a request of an arrangement of 13 American Beauty roses for the funeral. Inside the payment was a card with a statement, "Love forever, Louise." The police weren't able to glean any further information about the caller's identity, as the calls had been made from payphones. Owen was buried in Memorial Park, Kansas City, Kansas, shortly afterwards. The only people to attend the funeral were police officers. Undercover detectives staked out Owen's grave for the next few days, but no one else visited the site. The case went cold until autumn of the following year, 1936. A woman in Birmingham...
So sorry, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
At this point...
No, do not interrupt me.
At this point, they don't know who this guy really is.
No, which is what's making the investigation so difficult, I think.
Yeah, so they still only know his two other names. Because I was just thinking about, oh, no one came to the funeral. But it's like, they don't know who this guy is.
No, so and loads of people have been like...
We don't know anything about his life.
We don't know anything about him. There's this Louise character who's paid for some... roses and a man
and this other person who's paid for the burial, but like,
yeah,
they're not coming, obviously, so there's something strange and suspicious about their relationship to him.
But also they'd have to be pretty stupid to go to the, like,
well, yeah. But I mean, if they had,
but
like,
it's a weird thing because it's like this guy was so brutally murdered,
yeah,
but at the same time whoever did that has enough of an emotional attachment to him that like they want him to have a proper funeral and will, like, pay quite a hefty amount for that to happen.
And they claim it was a revenge, an act of revenge for cheating.
Yeah.
Okay.
The case went cold until autumn of the following year, 1936. A woman in Birmingham, Alabama, was reading the article about the Roland T. Owen case in American Weekly and thought that the picture of the victim resembled her friend's son. She brought the article to her friend, Ruby Ogletree, who agreed that the photo looked a lot like her son, Artemis, who she hadn't seen in person since 1934. Ruby Ogletree got in touch with the KCPD and was able to identify her son by describing in detail the scar on his head, which she explained had been caused by a childhood accident involving hot grease.
What year is it currently?
1936.
Not currently in real life.
So she hasn't seen him for two years. And he's been dead for a year.
Okay.
The true identity of the victim of room 1046 had been found. Artemis Ogletree. According to Mrs. Ogletree, her son had decided
to hitchhike. Such a cool name.
It is. Ruby and Artemis Ogletree truly sound like characters in a fantasy novel. According to Mrs. Ogletree, her son had decided to hitchhike to California with a friend named Joe Simpson in 1934, aged 17. This would mean that he was only 18 years old when he was brutally murdered.
He was what?
He was 18. So
they
nowhere...
estimated his age between 20 and 35, yeah, and he was a teenager.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is, like, I don't know who gave the figure of, like, 35, but there is no way that an 18-year-old
man... Sounds
like
someone
man...
who was really worried about being wrong.
Yeah.
I can maybe see myself panicking and being like, oh, I'm not sure, like, especially eyewitness testimony is so, like, you know, it's difficult when you see something, just try and look back on it. It's, yeah.
I would say maybe late 20s at the most, I would guess, for someone who's 18. But
it also, it could be impacted by how he dresses. So if he's dressed a certain way.
And I guess
way,
he behaves might... in a way that's, I mean, they don't have many interactions with him, but he seems quite mature for his age. Although, again, this is like the 30s, so I don't know. Artemis had kept in touch with his family through letters and explained that he and his friend had parted ways in Los Angeles. He had arrived in Kansas City in August, staying at the St. Regis Hotel and the Paseo. When police investigated these hotels, they were able to ascertain that Ogletree had stayed there, accompanied by another man who checked in under the name Donald Kelso. Perhaps the mysterious Don hotel staff had heard Ogletree interacting with. Where things get even more sinister is that Artemis Ogletree's killer began corresponding with Mrs. Ogletree after his murder. In January 1935, only a few weeks after the murder, Ruby Ogletree received a typewritten letter from her son informing her that he was going to New York. She received another typewritten letter in April 1935 informing her that Artemis was leaving for France. Mrs. Ogletree was very suspicious of these letters. Her son's previous letters had been handwritten, and as far as she knew, he didn't know how to use a typewriter. Furthermore, they were a lot more loquacious and used more colloquial language than his other letters. On the 12th of August 1935, she received a long-distance phone call from Memphis, Tennessee. She spoke with a man who identified himself as Godfrey Jordan. He said that Artemis had married a wealthy woman and was living in Cairo, Egypt, which was why he couldn't call her himself. The caller explained that Artemis had saved his life in a fight with a, quote, band of thugs. He said that Artemis had lost a thumb in the fight, which meant that he was unable to write letters, but that he was well. Ruby spoke with this man for about half an hour and described him as wild and irrational, although he did seem to know Artemis fairly well. Ruby Ogletree became more and more concerned for her son's well-being. The letters and the call had done nothing to assuage her worries. She reportedly contacted government and customs authorities to see if her son had been issued a passport or if there was any trace of him leaving the country, which there was not. She even contacted the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation and the consulate in Cairo with no success. In January 1936, she even wrote to the president, Franklin Roosevelt, writing, "I fear he has fallen into some gang or something has happened to him. He has always been a good boy and has high ideals. I simply must find some trace of him. If he is in trouble, I want to know." It would only be in November of that year that she would see Artemis's photo in the magazine and identify Roland T. Owen as her son. Despite confirming the victim's identity as Artemis Ogletree, the killer has remained unidentified to this day. In 1937, New York police arrested a man named either Joseph Martin or Joseph Ogden. I found conflicting information about his name. He had shot and brutally dismembered another man named Oliver George Sinical, or Seinkel. Police came to the conclusion that Joseph Martin, or Ogden, could have been involved in the murder of Artemis Ogletree for several reasons. He had spent time in an asylum in Birmingham, Alabama, where the Ogletrees were from. His handwriting was similar to samples from the letters sent to Rubel Ogletree.
Rubel.
I'm sorry.
Rubel Ogletree.
His handwriting was similar to samples from the letter sent to Ruby Ogletree, and most notably, he used the alias Donald Kelso, the same name used by Artemis Ogletree's companion in Kansas City. This led police to believe they had solved the case, although when the FBI reviewed the evidence in 1950, they came to the conclusion that the handwriting samples did not match and that the killer had not been found. As no new evidence came to light, the case eventually went cold.
It's a bit strange to go so strongly off of handwriting evidence. Like, oh no, it couldn't possibly be based on handwriting.
Well, it's also strange to review a case. Like, it seems unusually diligent to be looking at a closed case and then to reopen it and be like, no, this is not enough evidence to claim that this man killed him.
But what do they think is the motive in those scenarios? Do they still think it's the cheating thing? Because, like, what's the connect? Like, have they managed to connect up any of these characters?
I'm not sure why Joseph Martin or Ogden was in an asylum, but he had been in an asylum in Birmingham, and they maybe at this time had, like, identified Artemis and then presumably had followed him across the country and then murdered him in Kansas City. I'm not really sure what the theory is here, other than that he's committed a similar crime.
And the motive would just be being crazy.
Yeah, and has the same alias as this person in the Artemis Ogletree case, which is, you know, not insignificant, but...
But that it's not impossible, but it's like, so the motive is just a crazy guy gets it obsessed with you and then kills you, which I mean, it's not unheard of, but it's rare. I guess if you're a serial killer, there is really no motive per se, but...
Yeah, but it's also like that would take... It took him a year to travel around the country, so like to be following someone for that long, I don't know.
Yeah, something doesn't add up about that, so maybe that's why the FBI was like, actually, never mind that.
So due to its bizarre nature and its many unanswered questions, this case has spawned a lot of theories over the years, which we'll discuss now. So one of the most prominent theories is the one provided by the anonymous caller who paid for the funeral, that Artemis Ogletree had been engaged to a woman and then had had an affair. His fiance and perhaps a male friend or relative of hers and another woman would have sought revenge for this behavior. This could potentially explain the sighting of Ogletree with two women at liquor places on the night of his murder. Mm. But again...
But I find it a bit strange that this... So he's engaged to a woman and cheats on her, but there's no... These people aren't linked to anyone? He got engaged to someone and he never met her family?
Also,
he never,
his
like,
mother doesn't know anything about...
Yeah, his mom doesn't
this
know
this fiancé.
But even on the other side, even if he was, like, trying to live a new life, they must have both been, because, like, she didn't introduce him to any of her friends or family. They were never seen together. We don't know who this woman is. She's just...
Yeah. Although maybe it's possible that this had all happened somewhere else and then he'd, like, trying to flee this situation, had gone to Kansas City and they tracked him down.
I guess.
And then none of her family's coming forward because, you know, either they don't, it's like, oh, you know, that situation with that guy who cheated on you, let's not talk about that. Or they know that she, like, straight up killed him and they don't want to turn her over to the police.
It just seems a bit like it seems a bit odd that it sort of appears like it's the story is existing in like a vacuum with no like links to other people, no like witnesses saying like, oh, I knew a woman, she was in this relationship with this guy, looks like
no
him.
Exactly.
So it
and
seems
like,
weird.
Yeah, and also I don't know, being cheated on is not a nice experience and I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but would you, having been cheated on, would you like, I mean, I guess your reputation has also been damaged at this point, but like, would you really rally up like two other people and go and like hunt this guy down to kill him?
I think I'm not saying I wouldn't, but stranger things have happened, like people have done stranger things. I think if you like, that could happen. I wouldn't rule it out, but it is like, yeah, it is weaker maybe as a motive.
But then it does sort of track with the emotional connection to Artemis.
Yeah, and maybe then it's the kind of crime, because like you're saying, would you really do that? Like maybe in a fit of kind of like ongoing just emotional rage, you would, and then later you might regret that, especially if you were the male accomplice. You might then feel very guilty about being involved with it, and maybe you would then pay for the funeral, you know, stuff like that. And maybe feelings, then send flowers if you are feeling bad about it. But it is unhinged behavior, yes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he was willing to, like, talk about it with them, but then why was he being locked in his room? Then who's Don? Is he the male accomplice in this crime?
Who's he talking to when he says he's not hungry? I don't know. There are little things that kind of don't get an answer when you put this story in there. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Others speculate that Artemis Ogletree was involved in a relationship with another man, the elusive Don. The two had stayed together at other hotels in Kansas City, and it could explain Ogletree's desire for privacy. Supporters of this theory speculate that the relationship could have turned abusive, resulting in Ogletree's brutal murder. The illegal nature of homosexuality in the US at the time could explain why Ogletree refused to give any information about the attack to the police, either out of some misguided desire to protect Don, or because he believed that he would survive the attack and did not want police to know that he was gay.
I can kind of maybe see an abusive male partner angle. That sort of, you can answer quite a few things with that, actually.
Yeah.
You could answer, you know, like, you can still say he would talk in a certain code. Like, do you want me to visit? No, I'm not hungry. You know, like, don't visit now because it's not.
Yeah, or even that could just be like a partner, like, straight up offering to bring you food and you being like, no, I'm not hungry.
And it does kind of feel like even if that is like what you're saying, if it is like, is exactly what he says, that he's not hungry and then he has to insist, that sort of adds up with a kind of controlling partner who's like, time to eat, we're going to eat now. And you're like, you know, trying to assert some kind of control over your basic life.
And then like not being allowed to leave the room at certain times and having to account for your like whereabouts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I do see this because what it accounts for is like gaps in the story, because he specifically wouldn't want people to know about this aspect of his life.
Mm. In order for that theory to make sense, you have to say that there's no relevance to any of the like sightings of him with the women or like the women coming and going. And you would have to say that had nothing to do with it. Or that there was like another way to work that in that I can't think of right
now. I guess it's like he could have just been hanging out with friends.
Mm.
Another theory is that Artemis had gotten involved in mob business of some kind. Supporters of this theory point out that Don is a term used to refer to a mafia boss. Which it is, but I don't know if you'd be like...
I don't know if you'd be so open about it.
referring to him as Don.
Yeah, I think... I don't think you would openly be like, yes, Don, but I don't know. I can't say that I've got that much experience of like mafia.
Secret messages
like,
to your mafia communication. Boss.
Yeah, right.
So in this scenario, Ogletree could have gotten in over his head and perhaps betrayed the mob in some way. This could also explain his reluctance to name his attackers to the police.
Mm.
Supporters of this theory also speculate that the phrase "cheaters get what's coming to them" could refer to Ogletree's gambling issues, theorizing that he owed money to the mob.
Interesting one.
I do see that, but then it's like the context in which that sentence was spoken is from this person who's claiming that Owen is a cheater in the sense of someone who's had an adulterous affair. Mm. So it seems odd that this person would construct this story of like infidelity and then also tack on that he's a gambler, but
maybe it's like coded language, but I'm not sure why they would do that. I also don't know that the mob would like pay for your funeral.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that I find it hard to explain the sentimental aspect of it and the killers like staying involved, paying for the funeral, and also staying in touch with his mom. Like, that seems completely unnecessary.
If no one had ever called and done anything, then I would be like, yeah, sounds right. Unless
maybe
it's like,
maybe it's like
this?
The abusive partner is in the mob.
I was just about to say the same thing. I was like, what if it's both? Bring them together. So like, well, you've like fallen in love with an abusive like gang boss.
Well, I was even going to say, not even a gang boss, but like, part of a gang, and then the gang turns against the partner, or is like, and then like attacks him as revenge for something that the partner has done.
And then the partner would be the one like paying for the funeral, obviously, and being regretful about it. But then why would they spin? I guess they would spin the story as like a cover up, the cheating story.
Yeah, that would throw people off the trail enough, because it's like, oh, I don't want people to find out that this is A, mob business, and B, a homosexual relationship. So I'm going to spin this tale where it's like a heterosexual relationship gone wrong. And because maybe it's unbelievable that a single woman could have committed this crime, I'm going to add other characters into this that also account for the fact that I'm a man contacting people about this.
I guess so.
But I don't know. According to Kansas City Magazine, Ruby Ogletree reportedly had a suspect of her own, Joe Simpson, the boy her son had left home with.
Right.
She tried to meet up with him in Birmingham for several years and finally confronted him on December 28, 1939. During their conversation, Simpson reportedly said that he was confident that police would never find the person responsible for the murder. Ruby reportedly looked him straight in the eyes and said, "I would know the voice that talked to me from Memphis." To which Simpson, quote, turned red, dropped his eyes, and was nervous. Despite writing of her suspicions to the KCPD, they did not take her theories seriously and simply informed her that Simpson had been, quote, duly interviewed, and they clearly did not view him as a suspect.
But what if he's the guy? What if he's the partner?
Because then it's like, okay, these two kids leave home together and the relationship turns sour. And he tries to maybe either, like, break it off and leave him in Los Angeles, and, like, then this guy follows him because he's, like, a controlling, abusive freak. And it all culminates in this murder.
Yeah, I can see that. And definitely there's, like, something in, like, with these two sort of boys leaving their hometown. It's, like, it sort of seems like a classic kind of need to hide our feelings for each other kind of thing, because people know who we are here. We can't be together. We have to, like, leave and become sort of nomadic or something.
But also that would explain, I mean, if he's a childhood friend of his, I don't know how long they knew each other before this, but he would know his mother and maybe feel guilty about it enough that he would want her to feel like her son's okay.
Yeah.
So I do find that part of it quite convincing, because he would know enough about Artemis to, like, convince a person that he knew him intimately. And he would have a reason for, like, what, first of all, knowing how to contact his mother, knowing that he had a regular correspondence with her, and then, like, coming up with this bizarre story that, like, really does paint Artemis in a very positive light, but also explains that there's never going to be any contact with him again. But he seems to be living a very a fabulous life in Cairo with an extremely wealthy wife, and that everything's great and we don't need to worry about him anymore.
Well, one thing though I just started thinking about was the manner of death is quite, like, when you think of a kind of abusive relationship turns really crazy and the person is accidentally killed, it's usually not intentional. But if it is intentional, it's usually part of a sort of, I guess you would say, a commonplace aspect of violence in the relationship that has then been taken to a place, let's say. But this seems very much like almost like a torture situation.
Like they're trying to get information out of him or something.
Yeah, or just, like, you know, I really want this person to suffer, but it's like it's more than a kind of, I don't know, there seems like there would have to be another angle in there to explain the nature of the actual crime itself and how brutal it is compared to, you know, obviously any murder of an intimate partner with violence is brutal, but, like, just the way that it's done is just, like, it's not quite maybe congruent with, like, I battered this person, I went too far one time. I don't know, it seems more like orchestrated, more like thought about beforehand, like they've got a knife, you know, they're doing, like, it's, they're stabbing, there's beating. Or you could also say, like, an abusive partner might believe that you've done something wrong when you haven't. You know, like, that person might be quite paranoid, like, maybe he was, like, thinking he was seeing another guy or something, and then he would be exacting revenge.
Well, also, Artemis clearly didn't want to be found.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that he's asking for a room several floors up, he doesn't want it to be seen from the street, so maybe he's trying to get out of this abusive relationship, and this other person doesn't want to accept that. But then I was also thinking, I don't know if the cauliflower ear was ever explained, like, if his mother either knew.
Oh yeah, I forgot about the cauliflower ear.
You know, like, he's had it for a while, or he had explained how this had happened. And I could see that potentially being, like, a result of, well, I don't know, maybe he does do amateur boxing in his
that
free
could
time,
be a result,
but that could
of
be a result
ongoing
of,
abuse,
yeah,
though, couldn't it?
That's what I was thinking.
I had forgotten about the cauliflower ear, to be honest. But yeah, that does sort of fit in. And I don't know, maybe if you're, yeah, maybe if you are on the run from an abusive partner, you've already betrayed them then. So maybe there would be like a very brutal, premeditated kind of attack with like instruments and tying up and things like that, because you've already done the sort of bad thing to them. It's not like,
yeah,
going too far in a beating or something.
But then I'm also unclear as to, like, was he supposed to be dead when they left him?
I feel like it was definitely, I think that whoever it was thought he was dead. That's just my instinct.
Yeah.
But also, because you can, like, you know, when you're, if they thought they had to escape in a hurry, they probably wouldn't, like, check very well that he was dead. Mm-hmm. And then they just kind of leave as quickly as they could, not realizing maybe that he was still breathing. But he would have been like knocked out, you know.
Yeah. Which of the theories do you think is the most plausible? Or I guess, like, what are your final thoughts?
My most liked theory, and I mean liked in the sense of like I like the way it lines up with the evidence, not I enjoy the story. But I do like the intimate partner with the kind of, I think the childhood friend as well, it sort of matches up with this kind of blossoming, intense relationship that's maybe abusive and goes wrong. And he's either betrayed them by leaving them or betrayed them by having, or being perceived to have had a relationship with someone else, or wanting to have a relationship with someone else or something like that, that makes that person very paranoid. Or yeah, just something like that. And then this person finds him while he's there, and that's the locking from the outside, the controlling aspects, the calling him on the phone, and he's like, no, I'm not hungry, and stuff like that. Then that's like stage two. Let's say he's been found, this person's like in the hotel or in the vicinity of the hotel, and then they don't want to be heard having the conversation when the maid's there. Then the eventually like the person kills him or attempts to kill him, and then absconds. Maybe the fact that they left without any kind of attempt to maybe clean up the scene, or and that they're not seen at all is quite strange, because as you say, they would have needed to clean up quite a bit to not be noticeable. But we don't know the layout of the hotel too intensely, like there could be another way to get out, like some kind of fire escape or something. And finally, I like that with the calling up and paying for the funeral afterwards, because there is a sentimental relationship from this person, even if they were abusive and horrible. But I also like they weren't abusive and horrible, but they were part of the mob and things went wrong there. And then paying for the funeral still makes sense as well. And then spinning the stories about the cheating, I would say, is just a way to cover up what really happened.
Yeah, because I was thinking, what I find interesting is that the maid notices that he's quite worried. Like, he's behaving in a way that's, he is nervous, he's trying to hide something. But at the same time, they're having these chats. And at no point, again, like, at no point does he seemingly divulge any kind of like, please help me kind of thing? Like, I'm in danger. Like, he doesn't alert them to the fact that he might be in danger.
I don't think he would think that they had the power to save him.
No, but what I find interesting is that he insists on telling two different people that he was at the Muleback Hotel the night before, in a way that's like, you can find, like, remember this detail about me, because you'll be able to track my movements. Like, if something happens to me, maybe that, I don't know, he could have just been making conversation, but.
No, that is interesting though. I hadn't thought of that. And what, maybe it's like, that's his cry for help, maybe.
Because he knows he's been using these aliases, there's nothing that connects him to anything. But maybe you can, like, you'll notice that something's a bit off here if you're able to track him to the previous hotel and notice that he's also using an alias there.
What's your favorite then? Favorite theory?
I think, yeah, similar to yours. I think there's like, there's so much we don't know. And it's, you can sort of like combine multiple theories for one theory to make sense.
Yeah.
I do think that like, aside from, okay, maybe there was this woman who was walking around, he was seen with two women, and the fingerprints on the phone were perceived to be feminine.
Mm.
But other than that, we haven't actually directly heard from any woman involved in this case. And the, like, leaving the note with Louise seems so obvious that it's, like, trying to mislead. Because there would be no reason for someone who's killed a person to give any kind of name at that point. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems so intentionally meant for misdirection.
Right.
But again, that could fit with any of the theories.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any other, like, piece that we're missing from, like, that we haven't discussed, but...
I guess, there's always was a spy. Can always throw that in somehow.
Yeah.
And again, the story would need to be
covered
up. I guess
this wasn't this wasn't like peak spy times though.
What was peak spy times? Please elaborate.
Well, like during the wars,
I guess. But this is still, I mean, it's between wars, right?
Yeah. So was Missouri the hot spot of like, I don't know, secret intelligence?
I guess you're right. That doesn't really add up. But
he could be like on the lam.
I'm gonna just admit that I don't know what that phrase means.
Like on the run.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, and also he's like a teenage, I don't think it's very common.
Yeah, he's also like 17.
For someone to be a fully fledged spy by 17.
Yeah. Recruited straight out of Birmingham, Alabama.
Although I love the idea of this, like, of like a young adult novel series about Artemis Ogletree, the teenage spy, because it feels like a cool story.
Yeah.
But thinking about it, that doesn't seem very likely.
Yeah. It would almost fit if we went with the sort of version of events presented to his mum by the killer, of like, oh, and then he went to France, and then he moved to Egypt, and like, he's leading this international life of mystery, but
that's probably a lie.
Yeah. Well, that's that for the case of Artemis Ogletree. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel on whatever platform you listen to these. We're also on social media if you'd like to connect with us there. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you have any thoughts or theories related to this case. I think there are so many ways you could, like, interpret the evidence. So we're on Twitter at About Murder, on Instagram at A Podcast About Murder, on Facebook, it's A Podcast About Murder with no E, and you can always send us an email at apodcastaboutmurder@outlook.com.
See you all next week. Speak to you all next week.
Yeah. All right. Have a good weekend.
Why do we never figure out a good sign off? We just faff around.
I don't know.
Until it trails off. It's just like our signature.
Okay.
Bye.